Hello, Robert Christensen. Thank you for this interview. It's a pleasure to stay with you. Rob, what is the acute coronary syndrome? How big a health problem is the acute coronary syndrome?
Yes, Hernan, thank you very much. The pleasure is all mine to speak to you and the folks in South America. So it's a great honor to be here with you today. The question is, I'll handle it in two parts. The first part is, what is the acute coronary syndrome? The acute coronary syndrome is a spectrum of disease which involves the heart, which ranges from unstable angina to frank myocardial infarction with large areas of necrosis. The common theme in acute coronary syndromes is the unstable coronary plaque. Now, coronary plaques are formed throughout life. They start off as early as the late teenage years, and they start off as fatty streaks. And these fatty streaks evolve into eruptions on the inside of arteries, which are indeed plaques. Now, when these plaques become unstable, that's when they can erupt and expose their contents to circulation, which can activate platelets and also activate the coagulation cascade, which causes thrombosis. And this thrombosis, of course, can cause myocardial ischemia and then full blockage, which leads to myocardial infarction, that is, cell death in the heart. There are a couple of classifications of myocardial infarction. The two that are of greatest interest to individuals in the emergency department are type 1 and type 2. Type 1 myocardial infarction is just what we've been talking about. It's spontaneous myocardial infarction related to ischemia due to a primary coronary event such as plaque erosion, rupture, or fissuring of that plaque. Type 2 myocardial infarction is secondary to ischemia due either to increased oxygen demand or decreased supply. And this is a type of infarction you'd see with coronary artery spasm, coronary embolism, anemia, arrhythmias, hypertension, or hypotension. The second part of your question had to do with how large a health problem the acute coronary syndromes represent. I can speak to U.S. data in which there are 500,000 coronary heart disease deaths per year. If you think about that, that's like three jumbo jets crashing each day. That's the number of folks in the U.S. that die from the acute coronary syndromes. This is a huge problem in the U.S. Care system, as well as in many places in South America, where there in the U.S. between 6 and 10 million patients present to the emergency departments with signs and symptoms of coronary heart disease. So this is a very large healthcare problem worldwide.
Very interesting, Rob. And how can the laboratory come help? What's the preferred test for the diagnosis of myocardial infarction?
The preferred test for myocardial infarction has really been an evolution ever since about 1950, when the very first biomarkers for coronary artery disease and acute coronary syndromes were used. The very first one was the enzyme AST in the 50s, up through the 60s and 70s, total creatine kinase, myoglobin became very popular. Up through the 80s, CK-MB mass assays were developed. And then it was about the 90s, in the mid-90s, through this part of of the 21st century, cardiac troponin has become a very, very important marker. In the past, there were really several markers that have been used, one being myoglobin, because it was felt that this relatively small protein was released early after myocardial injury. Then CK-MB, which is used in many labs today, but this was a more heart-specific marker than myoglobin. And then, of course, the cardiac troponins, which we'll mention several times during this interview. It turns out that total CK, total creatine kinase, consists of three isoenzymes. One that is very specific for a skeletal muscle, termed the isoenzyme. The other is very very specific for brain, which is called BB isoenzyme. And then there's a hybrid which has one M subunit and one B subunit, and this is called CKMB. There are really two types of assays for CKMB, one of which is called an activity assay. The activity assay just takes advantage of CKMB's ability to catalyze creatine and phosphate to creatine phosphate, and of course that reverse reaction. So it really is it's an enzymatic reaction, and in that way it's susceptible to many interferences. The second type of CKMB assay, which is actually superior to the activity assay, is called the CKMB mass assay. This assay actually treats the MB isoenzyme as a protein. So antibodies are developed against CKMB, and these antibodies form the basis of an immunoassay, which measures CKMB with high sensitivity and are very specific for this isoenzyme. Perhaps the best biomarker of for any disease is cardiac troponin, and cardiac troponin actually is an isoform of troponin, which is very very specific for the heart. And so when you see positive troponin, unless there's been an analytical interference, one should think heart. One should think that the heart is involved. And in fact, for the past 10 to 15 years, cardiac troponin is the preferred marker for myocardial infarction diagnosis and risk stratification.
How should cardiac troponin be interpreted for diagnosis of myocardial infarction?
So actually, have been several guidelines, and the redefinition of myocardial infarction actually depends on is based on cardiac troponin. In the year 2000, the Global Task Force put together the following, which is a typical rise and gradual fall of troponin, or a more rapid rise and fall of CKMB. These are the biomarkers, and this is in the presence of ischemic symptoms, so patient symptoms, development of characteristic EKG changes, and this is how the diagnosis of myocardial infarction is now recommended. The NACB, the National Academy of Clinical Biochemistry, also put out guidelines, and they also state that a cardiac troponin is the preferred marker for risk stratification and myocardial infarction. And if available, cardiac troponin should be measured in all patients with suspected acute coronary syndrome. But most recently, in 2007, the universal definition of myocardial infarction was published. And here it is that one value in a series of troponin measurements, one value above the 99th percentile of an upper reference limit should be considered diagnostic for myocardial infarction.
What's the difference between clinical performance of CKMB and cardiac troponin?
So CKMB, as I mentioned before, CKMB was a very important marker up through the 80s and 90s, and even to this, even till today, it's used in some. The issue is that there are many patients who have negative values for CKMB. So in other words, their CKMB values are below a cutoff for myocardial infarction. When the troponin value for these same samples is positive for myocardial infarction, and this is really quite frequent. This can vary between say 12% and about 50% of patients, again, that are positive for troponin may be negative for CKMB. So CKMB is a much less sensitive test for myocardial infarction than is cardiac troponin. And this is one reason that cardiac troponin is the preferred assay. In most studies that have been done comparing head-to-head cardiac troponin and CK-MB, the cardiac troponin has been superior both for sensitivity and specificity for the diagnosis of myocardial infarction.
What are some of the diagnostic specificity problems with cardiac troponin?
Yes, this is a very important question about diagnostic specificity for cardiac troponin. I mentioned that when you see an increased troponin value, one should think heart. So it's very important to note that cardiac troponin is a tissue-specific marker, but not a disease-specific marker. In other words, there are many disease conditions which show increased troponin, which are not acute coronary syndrome. Some of these are ischemic stroke, even in a population of medical ICU patients, you can see increased troponin, gastrointestinal bleeding. There are many respiratory causes, for example, acute pulmonary embolism. Cardiac inflammation can cause troponin release, endocarditis, myocarditis, pericarditis, sepsis. So there are chronic diseases such as end-stage renal disease, amyloidosis, and so on. And even interestingly, myocardial injury. So, for example, blunt trauma to the chest, snake bites, jellyfish, centipedes, and even scorpions. Scorpion bites can cause release of troponin, but is not from the acute coronary syndromes. So again, troponin is a very heart-specific marker, but not a disease-specific marker. So these are other conditions that one has to consider when they see an increased troponin.
Thank you, Ro. We'll come back in a minute. What are the difference in performance of the between cardiac troponin methods?
Yes, I think it's very important for all of us to remember that all cardiac troponin assays are not created equal, and that cardiac troponin assays have gone through several generations. So if we go back to the earlier generations of troponin, say the assays that were available in the early 2000s or back in the 1990s, they are much less sensitive than cardiac troponin assays, the so-called sensitive assays that are available today. And some of these issues are are the very epitopes against which epitopes on cardiac troponin against which our immunoassays target. And one of these is if the cardiac troponin molecule has 209 amino acids, the 41 to 49 and 81 to 93 epitopes, those amino acid sequences, are particularly stable and are particularly good targets for assays. In fact, when one looks at all the troponin assays that are available, and a very good source for this is the IFCC website, which has all of the assays available, all the commercial troponin assays that are available worldwide. There's some 25 or so. You can see that if you look at that list, about two-thirds of them target that 41 to 49 amino acid range, and about half of them, which are dual assays, also target the 81 to 93 amino acid sequences. So those targets are particularly important. So good assays, I think those are important amino acid sequences to look at. Another characteristic for assays, for cardiac troponin assays, is that you really need a good precision at the 99th percentile of a reference control population. The goal for this, this good precision, should be in the range of 10%. Now, I will say that assays that show a slightly higher CV, coefficient of variation, at the 99 percentile cutoff are okay, say up to about 15% or so, but the goal should be 10%. Also, cardiac troponin assays must be characterized with respect to potential interferences that can affect any immunoassay. These include rheumatoid factor, human anti-mouse antibodies, and heterophile antibodies. Also, these assays really need to examine stability, that is, over time and across temperature ranges for each acceptable specimen type. So is serum only a specimen type, or can it be used in plasma from EDTA or plasma from lithium heparin and serum? All this has to be characterized for the various assays.
Rob, are there other conditions where cardiac troponin is clinically useful?
Currently, there are a couple of other conditions for which cardiac troponin measurements are useful. One of them is pulmonary embolism. It turns out that that extreme stress on the heart, on the right side of the heart, from a pulmonary embolism can cause cardiac damage, and this damage would be reflected in cardiac troponin release. But the one that I really think is going to have the biggest impact is in heart failure. We have to remember that acute myocardial infarction is a very big risk factor for development of heart failure. If we think about it, myocardial infarction is cell death of the heart, and as the heart remodels to compensate for this area that has scarred, which is no longer myocytes but is now scar tissue. We can think about that that there has to be a change in that tissue configuration with apoptosis and so on. So this can contribute to the release of troponin. Also, heart failure in many patients has an ischemic basis. So so there can be release of troponin from that area as well. Interestingly, 10% of all individuals over 65 years old have heart failure. In the U.S., that's about 4.7 million patients. So this is a very prevalent disease, and about 50% of these patients are asymptomatic, so they don't even know that their heart is remodeling. There have been a couple of studies that have looked at cardiac troponin in heart failure patients, and interestingly, these studies have shown that the rate of positive troponin results in heart failure patients, it ranges from 6.2% all the way up to 92%. So why is there such a wide range of results? Well, some of this has to do with the sensitivity of the assay used. We talked about that there are different troponin assay generations out there, and the earlier generations, of course, shows many fewer patients with positive results that have heart failure than the later generations. These papers have also looked at whether patients who have troponin release are at higher risk. Are they at higher risk of a bad outcome because there's evidence of their hearts actually releasing troponin. And there, indeed, that's true. Patients with heart failure patients with lower release of troponin are at much lower risk than patients that have higher troponin measurements. So this has led some investigators to state that that as we make the transition from chronic compensated heart failure to decompensated heart failure, that troponin assays may be a very important tool for managing these patients. And I do believe that cardiac troponin will have an important role in heart failure patients in the future. However, this role is in the future, and today I would not say that cardiac troponin in heart failure patients is a particularly useful test. And the reason is that we know that patients are at higher risk if they have troponin release, but we just don't know what management strategies are successful. And hopefully, as our evidence base improves with management strategies based on troponin, that we'll learn more and be able to benefit patients in this large class.
Rob, I see for the future a very, very important role of the laboratory, especially with the new definition of myocardial infarction. What is your final conclusion about the laboratory and with this pathology?
Well, that's an interesting point, because as we found that there isn't the safe level of troponin in blood is really very low. And in fact, that there are many that say that acute coronary syndromes are nearly normal in patients and in individuals. So this has caused a very low cutoff of troponin to be advocated by the various guideline groups. Of course, when you have a lower cut point for troponin, that means that you're going to have more patients that are positive. So the specificity of the troponin measurements is going to have to be traded off with sensitivity. So I think that's going to be a major challenge for laboratorians and for clinicians, is to find strategies, perhaps an increase, either a percent increase in troponin that is indicative of acute injury, rather than a troponin value that is above a certain cut point. So we still have a lot to learn about how to more precisely interpret troponin in acute coronary syndromes.
Rob, thank you very much. You are very clear with your explanation, and we are very happy to hear again. Maybe in the future we will call you again to make another interview. Thank you again, Rob.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Ramana.